Hello, this is Keith Pannell, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. Today, I'm back at the MD Anderson Hospital, part of the University of Texas system. I'm in the Proton Therapy Center, and today I'm going to be talking to Mike Gilling, who is one of the top scientists and physicists in this particular establishment. So, Mike, welcome to Science Studio.
Well, thank you. Look forward to this conversation.
Tell us a little bit about yourself before. You've obviously got a PhD in physics, and we'll come to where later on, perhaps. But what made you want to study this area of science?
Oh, I had a great high school physics teacher. I thought before that I was interested in chemistry, and then I have certain skills in math, and I just thought physics was very fascinating. And this was a long time ago, but there's nothing like a great teacher to inspire us all.
I mean, before that, did your parents encourage you when you were tiny to do experiments or collect moths or something like this?
Oh, yes. My father, by training, was an electrician. And he was born in 1898, and he finished fifth grade, and then he had to go to work. So his sons were going to, my brother and myself, were going to go to school. And I remember him talking to me about the development of the transistor and sometime in the 50s, I guess, and what an important development this was. I had no idea. He was certainly right, but I had no idea at that time.
All right. I mean, but the bottom line was he kept you engaged in what was happening in technology in this case.
Yes.
That's great.
Yes.
And your mother, too?
Oh, my mother was just a great mom.
All right.
She had two boys and was overwhelmed by the whole parenting of two boys experience.
All right. So anyway, you decided on physics because that was slightly more entertaining than chemistry.
Yes.
You didn't find the explosions and the smells and the colors. That didn't really get to you. Mathematics then must have been an important part of your
Mathematics
interest.
Was an important part. And the fact that there is this really close integration between applied mathematics and physics, I just found to be fascinating.
Then you went to university. Where did you study?
Oh, I studied, got my bachelor's degree from the University of San Francisco, which was located in the city of San Francisco itself, where I was born and raised. And then I have my graduate degrees from the University of California, Davis. University of California, Davis is located up by Sacramento in the Great Valley in California. Weather-wise, it was lovely because in the summer it would get very hot during the day, up to 100 degrees or something, and at night the fog would come over the coastal ranges and drop it down to 70 or so.
Right. No, I've been there, and it's delightful. And in fact, the campus, I think they still do have these London double-decker buses.
Oh, yes, they do.
And cart the students from one location to another.
Right? Yes.
Okay, so then you got a PhD in physics. Let's start with, what was your topic? What was your thesis all about?
It was an experimental nuclear physics project. And I got a great piece of advice. I was a graduate student for 6 years. I got a great piece of advice from the chairman of the psychology department as I was 4 or 5 years into this. I said that there were 4 people in the world interested in my thesis topic, and I was not one of them. And he said, who cares? Finish. And then don't be constrained. Go off and do what you are interested in. So just a great piece of advice.
It is. And I mean, I might interject here. It's not so easy to do that anymore.
Oh, I'm
right?
Sure.
You know, you come out of graduate school and you want to be a researcher. Let's assume that
right.
One in 10% of the people who graduate with PhDs, then they've got to find someone to employ them. Then they've got to find someone to fund the research that they want to do, as opposed to funding the research that the funders want done.
Right.
And this is an issue of too much directed research. This is my opinion. This is not a fact. But it's too much directed research, so that ideas are not so easy to sort of put into fruition. Wild ideas, especially.
Certainly. I don't think today one could have the career path that I had to make life slightly more complicated. I had a military obligation. In the United States, at this period of time, there was a draft.
Right.
And I had enrolled in ROTC. So after I got my PhD, I had to go into the United States Army. I spent 5 years in the United States Army, but was fortunate in there. Spent 1 year in the real Army, and then 4 years at Walter Reed Army Medical Center. 2 years in a training position, and 2 years on the staff there.
That's interesting, because the director of this facility has a similar history. Oh. You know, Dr. Frank was in the Naval Reserve.
Yes.
Not the Naval Reserve, Navy ROTC, and then nuclear submarines, nuclear engineering.
Right.
So the pair of you have got a very similar parallel career.
Yes, and I got I essentially did a fellowship in the Army.
Yeah, that's great.
And I got advice from a colleague of mine who's a graduate student with me. He said, you know, there will be jobs available in healthcare. I thought I was going to grow up and be a college teacher in some California State University, but there weren't any jobs, and they all were taken. And so I was steered towards healthcare, and have had a very enjoyable and successful career.
So right from the beginning, and somebody gave you the advice that healthcare and physics were somehow paired.
Yes, and I did get advice from a fellow graduate student. And it turns out there is this long history. The person who discovered X-rays was a physicist, Rankin. And there's a classic X-ray of his wife's hand with her wedding ring on it. And, of course, the medical applications of that were quickly realized. There was X-rays for a long time, and then radiation oncology developed early and continued to develop. After World War II, isotopes became available, and cobalt-60 was then being made. It was made by the Canadians. And so there were many cobalt-60 units. And then in the late 60s, linear accelerators, electronic devices, started to appear.
Okay, so now you're in a proton therapy institution of the MD Anderson Hospital, which is part of the University of Texas, and you are indeed a professor.
Yes.
So you did go into the academic career,
yes,
but in a slightly different manner. You're a clinical professor, or?
Yes.
Okay.
Very.
But do you have tenure?
No, I don't have tenure.
Okay, so that gives you a slightly different take on universities.
It does. I have a 3-year contract.
Right, and it renews and renews,
yes,
and renews.
And certainly what makes me a professor, I don't give lots of classes. I'm going to give some lectures next week, I don't give lots of classes. My primary responsibility are to make sure that patients are treated in a safe and accurate manner, and to publish on that and to develop.
I've seen your publication record. It's impressive. Let's talk then now precisely about the Proton Therapy Center.
Okay.
The Proton, as we've talked previously on this program to Dr. Frank, the director of the program, from a sort of a medical point of view. But let's talk a little bit about the generation of protons and why protons, right? What is it that protons bring to medicine that say X-rays do not? And what's the difference between a cyclotron and a synchrotron? All these things, the public, me included sometimes, don't quite get all of it.
Well, let's start with the basic physics. Protons are a charged particle. Electrons are a charged particle, but as a proton is about 2,000 times heavier than the electron. And that makes a difference as it interacts in tissue or water or what have you. The protons, as electrons, have a range. There's a probability that X-rays can go through 30 meters thick of concrete. But we know in water in particular what energy it takes to go to what depth. And this is true in the human body, too. And thus, they have the potential advantage of limiting the amount of normal tissue that becomes irradiated.
Well, in the sense that you can say if you've got a tumor 5 centimeters under the skin, then you can say, well, we want, therefore, an energy range that will dissipate its energy at 5.
Sure.
But it's still going to go through the other 4.9.
Absolutely.
And why is it that protons don't generate a lot of tissue damage before they reach the target?
Well, protons have a characteristic called a Bragg peak. And towards the end, when they're losing their energy, they lose their energy because they're through electromagnetic interactions with atoms and electrons and things. And as they lose their energy, they start to slow down, and then all of a sudden they lose lots of energy at once. And it's this ability to deposit lots of energy in a small volume that makes them important.
And what other species can do that? I mean, do X-rays do this? Do electrons by themselves do it? I mean, is this a generic energy loss for any charged or non-charged species?
Non-charged particles, photons,
right,
or neutrons, behave differently in matter. Charged particles, and that would be electrons and protons and everything up to carbon or heavy charged ions, the electrons don't have the characteristic Bragg peak, but these other particles have this ability to deposit most of their energy in a small volume.
So this was recognized a long time ago, because people did studies, I'm sure, in water. I mean, that's the classic solvent, doing that sort of study.
Yes.
When did it become clear, or maybe not just clear, but practical, to use the protons as a therapy for destruction of tumors?
Well, the popularity of protons has increased dramatically in the last decade or so. Massachusetts General Hospital, however, has been using them for close to 50 years. They used an old Harvard cyclotron and treated ocular melanoma, among other disease sites. Loma Linda University Medical Center in Southern California put in the first hospital-based proton system in the early 1990s. And then in the first decade of this century, multiple hospitals have developed these systems. The MD Anderson Proton Center has been treating for 8 years, but the plans for it, the groundbreaking, it was 3 years of the groundbreaking, it was 11 plus years ago, and planning obviously went on for some time before groundbreaking.
You weren't here at that initial instigation, if I can call it that, of the center.
No, I was not here at the when the initial plans were made. There were several teams. I was recruited to Houston, Texas, because of great expansion in radiation oncology here. And there was an acceptance, a team that developed the specs for the Proton Center and did the acceptance testing. But I came to work one day and was told by my leadership that in a year I'd be leading the clinical team to do protons. And I'm a very experienced clinical physicist and got some great colleagues, and together we made this device acceptable to use to treat patients.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm talking here with Professor Michael Gillen. He's from the MD Anderson Hospital in Houston, Texas, and he's the head physicist of the Proton Therapy Center. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. You've probably given blood at least once in your life because of the ongoing need for it. But blood has to be refrigerated and checked for infectious diseases.
Getting it to sites of natural disasters, war zones, and impoverished locations is challenging. So for 80 years, scientists have strived to develop an artificial blood substitute, and one group is getting close.
They're re-engineering the hemoglobin molecule to overcome a major problem faced by other researchers, which is to make an artificial hemoglobin that isn't toxic to the body.
Hemoglobin is the molecule in red blood cells that binds to oxygen and delivers it to cells around the body. When hemoglobin is outside the protective environment of red blood cells, it breaks down quickly and is quite toxic.
That's why scientists who've tried to infuse artificial hemoglobins called HBOCs, or hemoglobin-based oxygen carriers, the body system to process the molecule is overwhelmed. These free HBOCs cause people to develop jaundice, experience liver and kidney damage, and fatal heart attacks.
The new method is able to avoid toxicity by introducing into the artificial hemoglobin specific amino acids, the building blocks of proteins, in an effort to detoxify it. So far, this approach is working since these HBOCs are far less reactive.
This HBOC doesn't need refrigeration, can be given to all blood types, and wouldn't be at the mercy of willing donors.
With fewer people donating blood, supply will become an issue. With 40 million blood transfusions per year worldwide, the development of artificial blood will become a necessity.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back. This is Keith Pannell talking to Professor Michael Gillen, Professor of Medical Physics at the University of Texas MD Anderson Hospital, in particular the Proton Therapy Center. Okay, so we've got an idea. You've got these charged particles, and we can zap them into people, and by tuning the energy, we can say, where do we want most of the energy dissipated? We'd like to dissipate the energy in a tumor, kill the tumor, and obviously some live cells that aren't tumorous or are not cancer carcinogenic. But how do we generate the protons? Most of us know protons from litmus paper, at least that is the general public, the function of acidity. But this is a totally different game. This is not in solution. You've got beams of... How do you generate them?
Well, the protons originate as hydrogen gas in a little gas bottle. They are injected into a linear accelerator, and the electrons are stripped off. So you then have that charged particle. And the first part of the acceleration process, which takes you from zero energy to 7 million electron volts, is a two-stage linear accelerator. It's easy, in theory at least, it's easy for, if you're not an electrical engineer, to deposit energy to charge particles and accelerate them. They then go into a synchrotron. And a synchrotron is named that way because it's synchronous. The particles go around not in a circle, but in an oval type shape. And there are magnets there. The bending, the strength of these bending magnets increases as the energy of the proton increases. And every time they complete a revolution, they're given a little bit more energy. And when you get to the energy you want, they are extracted out at a fairly high extraction frequency, maybe 80 or 90%. Go down a high-energy beam line. They're charged particles, so they're subject to magnetic fields, and then can be directed into one of the four different treatment rooms we have.
And then it hits the patient.
Well, it goes through this gantry, which is really a fascinating bit of mechanical engineering, but is eventually directed into the patient.
So the hydrogen, you say it comes in little cylinders. How much hydrogen does it take? You know, in terms of the volume, if you could do that, or the number of moles, or however you discuss it, how much hydrogen do you need to operate the facility on a daily basis?
Oh, I don't know that, because the gas cylinder is pressurized.
Right.
It doesn't get changed very often. What I do know is the synchrotron is a pulsed instrument. It's not continuous. And what I do know, per pulse, we have 10 to the 11th protons.
Okay.
And
that's way less than Avogadro's number.
Oh, it, yes.
It's way less than 1 gram.
Yes.
It's amazing. Right.
It is amazing.
Yeah.
So a patient is treated how many pulses? Oh, 100 or 200 or something, but not a large number of pulses.
So, I mean, that brings us the second point here, that you're talking about different patients, different tumors, different targets, different depths, and therefore different energies.
Correct.
How do you go about, because I know that you've got four beam lines that are operating more or less sequentially, how do you go from one energy level to another energy level to another and then back to a third, fourth per patient? How does that process work?
There's a good control system. So you are directing the beam, say, into gantry one. And you can change the energies of the energy directed into gantry one. And then when you're finished treating in gantry one, the beam goes on to gantry two or three.
It's all coming from the synchrotron.
All coming from the synchrotron.
The energy of the protons in the system are uniform.
They are quite uniform, but they're not all the same. You can go from, in this device, go from about 70 MeV to 250 MeV.
All going around.
No. One energy per per spill.
And so you can change that energy just like that. I mean, that's the magic in a sense.
That's right.
Okay.
And it's the number of times they go around in the synchrotron.
Right.
As I said, they get a little bit of kick of energy. And the speeds are two-thirds the speed of light by the time we're through here.
But, the real point from the listener's point of view, from my point of view, is the fact that you can tune that energy rather rapidly.
Absolutely.
Otherwise, you'd be sitting waiting for, gantry 1 to gantry 2 or beam line 1, 2, and 3. But I gather that's not the way it works.
No, you're absolutely right. It is very quick.
What would happen if you used deuterium? Deuterium, for the listener, that's a heavy form of hydrogen. Instead of having just one proton in the center of the hydrogen atom, it's got one proton, one neutron. So when you charge it, it will still be positively charged but with twice the mass.
Oh, now you're asking some great basic physics. It certainly would take more energy. If you have more mass, it's going to take more energy to accelerate it. It would take more energy or stronger magnetic fields to direct it. And you don't want the neutron. You would lose this capability of depositing energy as highly focused as it is.
Even though it's charged, that extra neutron would be dissipating somehow energy.
That would be my guess. Somehow there'd be some sort of
reaction. Have done the experiment? I mean, have people looked at the deuterium cation, and that is the charged deuterium atom, in water in the same way and seen a similar sort of thing to a Bragg peak?
I don't know. I don't have personal knowledge of that, but it what distresses me is the thought of treating with high-energy neutrons. There would be some sort of interaction, and you'd free the neutron, and then you would dissipate the advantage of protons because you'd be putting more energy in all over the body that you don't want to put in.
You're saying you'd dissipate...
I think you would free the neutron from the proton.
You would?
I guess. Why not? I don't know that.
So that's an area which is not been particularly well studied because of the capacity for freeing a neutron and doing more damage than good.
That's my guess.
All right.
And the cost. If you're going to build accelerators to accelerate heavier particles, that's more expensive than it is to accelerate protons.
Okay, so that's another feature. I mean, the instrumentation that you have here, I think, is constructed by Hitachi.
It is.
Right? But other companies, because you were saying earlier that, Dr. Frank also said this in the previous program, that more and more of these centers are becoming apparent.
Yes.
I mean, in fact, I've seen, just today walking through, patients coming from Denmark. Apparently, they don't have such a facility. They will do in the future, I'm sure. It's a growth industry, I can call it that, or not?
Well, maybe. So, yes, there are machines that are made in Europe, several different vendors associated with Europe. There may be, I'm not sure there are any made in the States. Now, let's talk about a topic that I have a strong interest in, but clearly no expertise. And that's...
I have lots of those.
And that's healthcare economics. We need to, independent of what the modality is, whether it's medical oncology or surgery or radiation, you need to be able to prove effectiveness and efficiency in what the therapies you're offering. Now, a major question with respect to proton therapy is, what subset of patients clearly display advantages because of the costs associated with this? And the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center is working on answering that question. We have, within the last year, completed a phase 2 randomized trial for patients with stage 3 lung cancer, where we've compared X-rays to protons. We are waiting for that data to mature before we publish that, and hope to have that data out there.
So, I mean, if I can interject, that's a sort of experiment that has an issue associated with it, that if you begin to see, with your first experiments, your first patients, for example, that one of the therapies is much better than the other, then in a sense you begin to stop the experiment.
Well, yes, we don't tend to, I don't disagree with your description. We don't use the word experiment. This is a protocol. This is a protocol approved by our institutional review board. You can't experiment on people. That's ethical.
You just change protocols.
It's
semantics in one sense, is it not?
It is. But for lots of historic reasons, that's not a
problem. I understand.
And you have to have independent review. But we have done this. Dr. Frank, the medical director here, has recently published an observation about how better tolerated treatments are for oropharynx, for tumors of the mouth. And that certainly can be severe complications associated with that. So that if, I'm sure his observations are valid, that the patients need less overall care with protons, and thus, while the cost of delivering the proton therapy treatment itself may be greater, the overall cost of managing the patient is less. And these are important observations.
So it will turn out probably in let's say, 10, 15 years, there will be certain types of tumor, certain conditions, where there will be a clear check in the box for proton, and perhaps others where a clear check for x-rays or photon therapy.
Photons,
right.
So the other patient population we've not mentioned that we see here at the Proton Center are pediatrics. It is very difficult for, I'm not a physician, it's very difficult for me to understand why do two-year-olds get cancer. You know, they certainly haven't been in the sun too long or done things to their body or consumed things. But it happens. We have full-time anesthesia staff here. We can treat children, and protons irradiate less normal tissue. And that, all of us believe that. That's not an academic question. You know, all of us just believe that intuitively. And so they should have, hopefully they will, if you treat a two-year-old, hopefully they'll live 80 more years, and hopefully the consequences of that treatment will not be noticed.
And this is all sorts of cancers.
All sorts of cancers.
Wherever the cancer may be determined to be in the child.
Yes.
It's just the fact that the younger child, the proton has less of a long-term impact on healthy cells.
Yes, we're irradiating a smaller volume of healthy cells, and thus that is in the child's best interest.
We're coming close to the end of this little conversation, Mike. Tell me a little bit about your personal goals here. What is it that you see in the next 5 years? I want to answer this or that particular question associated with this proton therapy and the physics behind it.
There are some technical, and then there's another topic that we should talk about. Technical goal is we've not yet commissioned our ocular melanoma line. We'll have that next year. We'll be able to treat patients with ocular melanoma. But the really interesting challenge is information management. We need to develop systems so that we can review them and better look at what has happened to our patients over a period of time.
Mike Gillen, you know, thank you so much. Head physicist at the Proton Therapy Center, at the MD Anderson Cancer Treatment Center of the University of Texas here in Houston. Great pleasure having you here, and thank you very much.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
And we'll be back next week with another Science Studio, so you be there. Bye-bye.